Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. We are diving deep today into Yasunari Kawabata's really significant novel, Snow Country, or Yukiguni. And this isn't just, you know, a story. It feels more like stepping into this very intense, isolated world.
It really does. It forces you to confront this this tension, doesn't it, between just appreciating beauty and, well, actual human feeling, love, even.
Exactly. And it's the perfect text for this kind of deep dive.
Yeah.
Especially thinking about Kawabata himself.
Right. The first Japanese author to win the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yeah.
Back in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really separate the books from his life, I think.
How so?
Well, he experienced profound loss very early on. Parents, grandparents, all gone by the time he's a teenager. And that sense of solitude, of things just vanishing, it permeates his writing.
That definitely comes through. His style is so sparse. Lyrical, maybe?
Finally impressionistic, yeah. It's all about these fleeting moments, these themes of impermanence and isolation. They're absolutely the bedrock of Snow Country.
Yeah. Okay, so before we really get into the story, there's this key idea we need to touch on, right? Mono no aware.
Yes. Crucial. If you've come across it, you know it's not just sadness. It's deeper than that.
It's like a bittersweet feeling.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
It's this really profound awareness that beautiful things don't last. Think cherry blossoms or maybe intense passion.
It fades.
It fades, but there's a kind of beauty in that fading, a sort of gentle melancholy, an acceptance of loss as just part of beauty itself.
Okay, so let's set out our mission for today. We want to look at how this beautiful idea, this acceptance of impermanence, kind of warps for the main character.
Right, how it almost becomes a shield.
Yeah, a shield that stops him from actually connecting with people, that messy, real human stuff.
So it's aesthetic detachment versus, well, maybe ethical responsibility. All set against this stunning but also quite harsh, snowy landscape.
Let's get on that train then. The novel kicks off with probably one of the most famous opening lines in literature.
Oh, absolutely. It's instantly dramatic. The train came out of the long tunnel into the snow country.
Simple, but powerful.
It's like a signal, isn't it? To the reader, to us. We're leaving behind the everyday world, Tokyo, the mundane.
And entering.
Entering this isolated, almost mythic place. The tunnel is like a gateway. Emotions get heightened, the usual rules. They're kind of suspended by all that snow and distance.
So who are we traveling with on this journey?
Our protagonist is Shimomura. He's from Tokyo, wealthy, married. But the key thing is his detachment.
He's a man of leisure, right? Doesn't really do much.
Exactly. He approaches life like an observer, a kind of dilettante, almost purely intellectually.
Isn't there that detail about ballet?
Yes. It's so telling. He studies Western ballet, but only from books and pictures. He prefers the idea of it, the clean image.
Not the reality.
Not the messy reality of, you know, dancers sweating or maybe making a mistake. He's an aesthetic tourist, basically.
Yeah.
He wants the purity of his imagination, not real life.
But waiting for him in the snow country is Komako. And she is, well, she's intensely real.
Passionately, undeniably real.
Yes.
She's the geisha who becomes a novel's tragic heart.
Tell us a bit about her. She's not just a passive figure.
Not at all. She's incredibly intelligent, very disciplined. She keeps these detailed diaries. She's mastered the shamisen, which is a really demanding instrument.
And she's trapped.
Utterly trapped in this transient life. She became a geisha at this remote hot spring, basically out of necessity. She made this huge sacrifice.
To pay for someone's medical bill.
Yes. For a young man, Yukio. It was a heartbreaking choice, and it defines her situation when Shimomura meets her again.
So her relationship with Shimomura, it's everything to her.
She pours her whole self into it, all her hope, her passion, her future dreams, into these intermittent visits from him.
While he just observes her.
Like the ballet?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He sees her passion, her intensity, through this lens of performance. It's beautiful to watch.
Oh, that's bleak. Can love even work like that? When one person is giving their entire reality and the other just sees it as beautiful scenery?
Well, that's the central question, isn't it? And the tragedy. She represents this overwhelming, almost desperate human effort. And to him, she's just another fascinating aesthetic experience. Something beautiful, but ultimately fleeting.
Destined to be wasted effort, as the novel puts it.
Yeah. And this dynamic gets even more complicated with Yoko.
Ah, Yoko. The third key figure. She's this mysterious, almost ethereal young woman.
Shimomura first spots on the train.
She's with this sick young man, Yukio.
Yes, she's caring for him. And that first glimpse Shimomura gets of her is crucial.
The reflection in the window.
Exactly. Her face is reflected on the train window, but it's superimposed onto the snowy landscape rushing past outside. It's described as a phantom image.
So she represents what idealized beauty?
Untouchable purity, perhaps. Something Shimomura can admire from a distance without any messy involvement. She's the perfect aesthetic object for him.
A kind of rival to Kamako's very real, very needy presence.
A symbolic rival, yeah. Definitely. And you sense Shimomura almost instinctively prefers that illusion, that reflection, over Kamako's earthy reality. Okay, so the story unfolds across three main visits Shimomura makes. Let's track how this relationship, or lack thereof, develops. The first visit.
We only really see that in flashbacks. It happens in late spring. Kamako isn't a geisha yet. She's more of a companion. There's an initial innocence.
And Shimomura makes a promise.
A casual promise to return. Totally thoughtless on his part, probably. But for Kamako, it becomes this anchor. She holds on to it. He, meanwhile, likely forgets it almost immediately.
Then we get the second visit. This is where the main story really begins, deep in winter.
Right. He comes back through that tunnel, and the world is transformed, buried in snow. And Kamako's situation has transformed, too.
She's a geisha now.
She's made that sacrifice. She's fully immersed in that life. Their affair starts or deepens physically.
Yeah.
But that emotional gap, it just widens.
He's still just watching her.
Critically observing, always. Yeah. He sees her vulnerability, her drinking increases, her emotional outbursts, but he doesn't see it as desperation. He files it away as artistic passion, a beautiful performance of sorrow.
The power imbalance is just staggering. Socially, emotionally.
Devastating. And because the story is told almost entirely through Shimomura's perspective, that limited third-person view.
We're kind of forced to see her through his eyes.
Yeah. We experience Kamako through his detached, objectifying gaze, which makes us, the readers, almost complicit in his, well, his moral failure, you could say.
Which leads us to the third visit. Things are strained by now.
Very strained. It's nearly a year later, autumn approaching winter again. Kamako's desperation is palpable, almost suffocating. And Shimomura, he feels this cold finality. He intends this trip to be his last.
The end of his escape.
Exactly. The relationship is clearly at its breaking point.
And Kawabata uses this dramatic event to mirror that breakdown, right? The fire.
Yes, a literal catastrophe. A fire breaks out. Some sources say a cinema, others a cocoon warehouse. Doesn't matter precisely where. The point is chaos erupts in this isolated community.
And Yoko is there.
Yoko, that symbol of untouchable purity, is caught in the fire. She falls dramatically from an upper level. A balcony, maybe? It's clearly fatal. Or near fatal.
A shocking moment. But Shimomura's reaction... That's the key, isn't it?
It's pivotal. He doesn't focus on the falling symbol, Yoko. Instead, he witnesses Kamako.
What does Kamako do?
She rushes forward. It's this raw, almost animalistic act of pure human devotion. She grabs the dying, or perhaps already dead, Yoko, cradles her, screaming in anguish and protective love. It's messy. It's intense. It's absolutely real.
Kamako's ultimate display of connection.
Exactly. And here's the moment, the moral tipping point. Does Shimomura get pulled into this? Does he feel empathy?
No. He looks up.
He looks up away from the human tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And his gaze just detaches completely. He sees the night sky.
The Milky Way.
He experiences the cold river of the Milky Way flowing down and into him. It's described as this sublime, overwhelming, but totally impersonal aesthetic moment.
A transcendence that completely ignores the human suffering right there.
It dwarfs it, makes it insignificant in the face of this vast, cold beauty.
Wow. That's the ultimate confirmation, then, of his emotional failure, his cowardice, even.
It really is. He chooses the cosmos, the indifferent, beautiful pattern, over the messy, demanding reality of human pain and love.
Kawabata really exposes the danger there, doesn't he? That focusing purely on aesthetic perfection, taken to an extreme, can become a kind of cruelty.
Absolutely. It forces you to ask, is Shimomura's focus on beauty some kind of higher sensibility, or is it just moral evasion? The novel strongly suggests the latter, treating people as just beautiful objects, is inherently cruel.
Which ties right into that theme of wasted beauty, futile effort. You mentioned the Chijimi linen earlier.
Yes, it's such a perfect metaphor, drawn right from the setting itself, this special linen woven in the snow country.
What's so special about it?
Well, the process is incredibly painstaking. It requires immense discipline, and it can only be done in the freezing cold of winter. The threads are laid out on the snow to bleach them.
So huge effort involved.
Enormous, quiet, meticulous labor. But the finished cloth, its delicate, beautiful, mainly worn just for a short time in summer. Then it's often discarded, forgotten.
Destined for transience, just like Komako's efforts.
Exactly. Kawabata explicitly links her life to this fabric. Her passion, her art, her love for Shimomura, all this immense effort, this beauty created through struggle, ultimately unappreciated, wasted, especially by the one person she wants to see it.
That sense of waste really emphasizes the isolation, too.
Definitely. Isolation and the failure of communication. I mean, they're physically intimate, but fundamentally alone. Shimomura constantly misreads Komako.
Sees her desperation as just more performance.
He sees her drinking, her tears, her diary entries as part of her artistic passion or this beautiful wildness. He never seems to grasp it's a genuine cry for help, for connection.
That refusal or inability to truly see her is just devastating. You mentioned the way the novel was written, too, in fragments over years.
Yes, between 1935 and 1948. It connects to that neo-sensationalist movement in Japan, which focused on fleeting sensory impressions rather than solid plot.
Which explains why the prose feels the way it does. Sparse, suggestive.
Like a haiku, almost. It implies more than it states explicitly. The atmosphere, that mood of Mono no Aware, carries the story perhaps even more than the plot points.
That melancholy beauty.
It underlies everything. The beauty of the snow, the intensity of the love, it's all transient. But the isolation feels permanent.
And the symbols Kawabata uses really hammer this home.
They're unforgettable, aren't they?
The snow itself, purity, yes, but also isolation, coldness.
Then the mirror, the reflection constantly reminding us of Shimomura's preference for illusion, for the phantom image over the messy truth.
Like Yoko in the train window.
Precisely. And finally, that indifferent, vast beauty of the Milky Way at the end, confirming his choice. Aesthetic self-absorption over human connection.
So the lasting feeling is that melancholy, that sense of inevitable tragedy, especially for Komako.
Profound melancholy, yeah. Rooted in her unfulfilled longing. But it also challenges us, I think. It makes us look at the difference between appreciating life's beauty from a distance and actually living it, the pain, the mass, everything, and what we owe the people we claim to admire or even love.
So, wrapping up, what's the core resonance? Why does Snow Country still speak to us?
Maybe it teaches us that beauty often comes from loss, from accepting impermanence.
But that appreciation can't replace empathy. It shouldn't be an excuse for detachment.
Exactly. That aesthetic appreciation has to coexist with human responsibility, with connection.
It really forces you to ask, are you just an observer in your own life? Are you preferring the reflection over the real thing?
A challenging thought to end on.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.